So my topic today is, as clear as, electroshock. And whenever I tell people that I'm talking about electroshock, whether I told people this in the 70s or in the 80s or in the 90s or today, I've almost always gotten from some people the exact same response. How come wasn't that discontinued years ago? Well, let me be clear. Shock was not, electroshock was not discontinued years ago. And no, it didn't almost disappear. That those are kind of accepted ideas that people have. There is approximately the same amount of shock given today that there was in 84 when the Ontario Coalition to Stop Electroshock was in its heyday. And there promises to be more because there is a huge push right now by shock doctors. Many people may have read the article in the Globe a couple of days ago, the very misinformed article in the Globe, but what you can hear is that shock doctors are lamenting the tragedy of insufficient shock being used. And so it's a very important thing for us to be on top of. So let me start by saying a little bit about shock. It's a fascist invention, and when I say that, I'm not talking metaphorically. Some of the current trends in psychiatry began in Nazi Germany. Shock began in fascist Italy. It was invented in 1938 in fascist Italy by a man called Cerletti and seconded by a man called Bini. And Cerletti visited a slaughterhouse and saw pigs being pacified by the application of electrical prods to their heads. And he figured this was really good. Look at how calm and subdued they were, and he decided to try it on a human being. And a patient, a homeless man actually, was brought to the hospital where he worked against his will. And against his will, he was then used as a guinea pig. Cerletti, in the meantime, had invented a crude shock machine, and this man who had never came there and didn't want to be there was strapped down, and electrodes were attached to his head, and he was given electroshock. After the first few shocks, he screamed, "Not another one, it's deadly." That was the beginning of this highly touted treatment. There was some consternation in the room, and a few of Cerletti's colleagues got weak feet, saying, "Maybe we better stop," and Cerletti reasoned to himself, "If I don't push the thing now, it'll never happen," and so he continued. And so that was the birth of shock. And by 1940, it had already been introduced into the States, and by the early 40s, it had become a standard part of the psychiatric regimen. Shock today is not that much different than shock was in the 40s and 50s. It's not that much different than what you would have seen, actually, in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The only major advance in terms of shock is the giving of muscle relaxants so the back wouldn't break. And that, no question, that was a major advancement. People's backs were breaking. We hear a lot, and anyone active in the fight to stop shock hears a lot about new modified shock. Let me be clear. The primary difference between new, improved, modified shock and old, bad shock that we're apologizing for is that the first was unilateral and the second was bilateral. The first was bilateral and the second was unilateral. In bilateral shock, one electrode is put on each hemisphere of the head. In unilateral shock, both electrodes are put on the same hemisphere, presumably the non-dominant hemisphere. What makes this a bit of a joke is that the same amount of electricity is used, and research suggests the same amount of damage is done. And it's not even true that one form replaced the other. Psychiatrists sometimes use bilateral shock, sometimes use unilateral shock, and whatever shock they give, they declare it new, modern, effective, and completely safe. In the 80s, I was part of an organization that held 3 days of public hearings in which people who got shock came to testify. In 1999, the results of these hearings were published in an article by Froda and Baldwin. And the recurrent themes identified by the shock survivors were damage, terror, lack of safety, horrific memory loss. Many testified that they would prefer death to ever being subjected to this procedure again. All but two people who testified called for the complete abolition of electroshock. As I've said before, today I'm going to be discussing electroshock as a feminist issue. Before I need to do that, however, I need to clarify much more clearly what shock is and what it does on a simple, mechanical, scientific level. And I want to begin with the nomenclature. It goes by various names: shock therapy, electroshock, EST, and the more common ECT. ECT stands for electroconvulsive therapy, and that's the official name used in the medical journals. But I want to begin by introducing you to a definition which actually defines this in terms of how it produces its effect and what it does. And I'm quoting here from a neurologist, a man called Sidney Samant. Samant says, and I quote, "As a neurologist and an electrocephalographer, I have seen many patients after ECT. ECT produces effects identical to those of head injury. Electroconvulsive therapy, in effect, may be defined as a controlled form of brain damage produced by electrical means. In electroshock, a person is given an anesthetic and a muscle relaxant, also oxygen because they stop breathing. Then the person's head is attached to a shock machine by virtue of two electrodes. The machine is turned on, and then 100 and 100 to 150 volts of electricity is passed through the brain. Generally, a course is 6 to 8 treatments. The amount must be sufficient to create a grand mal seizure, a convulsion, hence the name electroconvulsive therapy. The purpose of the procedure is to create the grand mal seizure or convulsion. The effect, naturally, is brain damage. Significantly, in real medicine, doctors try to stop others from having grand mal seizures, as they know this means brain damage, not with shock doctors. They try to produce it, and they do produce it. Both the electricity and the seizure itself culminate in brain damage, and there's no question it does. It creates lesions in the brain bleeds, cells disappear, ghost cells appear, stuff such that neurologists like Salmon can recognize the brain damage from looking at scans of the brain after ECT. Now, we knew this in the early days. People knew this right from the beginning of shock. In the days of animal experiments on shock, a researcher called Hartelius did extensive experiments on cats. Now, I don't defend this research. I don't defend anything I would see as cruelty to animals, but I do want to tell you the results of the research. They did double-blind studies, and then they killed the cats, and there were autopsies done on the cats, and on the basis of the lesions produced, the researchers could identify which cats were electroshock and which were not with almost 100% accuracy. There are many more studies proving damage. Templer published in the British Journal of Psychiatry concluded that ECT causes permanent brain damage. Nowadays, psychiatrists are into denying that shock causes brain damage because they are confronted with a populist who, for some reason, is not so keen on brain damage, something they hadn't expected in the early days and didn't actually confront in the early days. But they didn't bother denying it in the early days because there weren't any objections. And so it's very important to go to these early people because they actually were honest about what it did. The early shock doctors made it very clear that it is precisely the brain damage or intellectual impairment that makes this treatment, quote, therapeutic, unquote. Let me quote here from the second biggest name in the saga of electroshock, psychiatrist and electroshock mentor Dr. Abraham Myerson. Myerson said, and I quote, "These people have more intelligence than they can handle, and the reduction of intelligence is an important factor in the curative process," unquote. It's a horrifying statement if you stop to think about it. Interrogate this language, and what you see is that these people are being conceptualized as inferior. Indeed, intelligence in these people is being conceptualized as a defect to be cured. Along with brain damage comes enormous memory loss. And it's not surprising there's memory loss. You put holes in people's head, it stands to reason that there's going to be memory loss. You rampantly destroy brain cells, and of course you're going to wipe out memory attached to those cells. Now, we know about memory loss from studies. There's umpteen studies that prove it. We know it from patient reports. Studies show that up to 90% of patients on ECT complain of ongoing memory loss. Of course, there are doctors who discount this evidence. In fact, many, many doctors, saying that the patients are imagining it and that these complaints are simply proof of ongoing neurosis. I'd like to point out that it's highly unlikely that all these people share the same illusion. I'm not so sure it's unlikely the psychiatrists share the same illusion. I'd also like to point out that validity is established by triangulating evidence, and it's not just the patients who are saying that we can't remember things. It's turning up in tests, it's turning up in research, it's turning up in government reports. In fact, significantly, an ECT review committee set up by the government in Ontario in the 80s to look into the Shoah clearly concluded memory loss. Let me quote here. ECT causes memory loss varying from minor and transient to severe and long-term. Actually, there's two kinds of memory loss created. There's retrograde amnesia, and that's loss of memory of things that happened prior to shock, and antegrade amnesia, that's inability to remember stuff that happens after shock. The ability to remember new things is impeded. In 1984, when we held public hearings into electroshock, almost everyone who testified said that they were impaired in their memory in both ways, both antegrade and retrograde amnesia. I can't overstate what a serious impediment to a decent life this destruction of memory is, this menticide is. We need memory to navigate the world. You cannot even go into a grocery store and shop if you cannot rely on memory. As human beings, we can't make decisions without memory. When we make decisions, we not only project ourselves toward the future, we project ourselves back into the past so we can make effective selections of behavior that disturbs us, that has served us in the past. We can't do that if we can't remember what we did in the past. We don't know what we like, what we are attached to, who we are. Memory is the foundation of our identity, and you interfere with memory and you profoundly interfere with the integral whole that is the human being. Interfere with memory and you create truly fractured identities, not the imaginary fractured identities of postmodernism. The more interference with our memory, of course, the more problems it poses for us. And significantly, that interference can be very, very major indeed. I want to say, as a therapist specializing in this, is I've seen people with 5 to 20 years wiped out. And there are people with more memory wiped out. Some shock survivors have had all of their memory before shock wiped out. Illustrative of this in this regard is Linda McDonald. At 23, she was a young married woman with children. She was depressed from the duties that fall to young mothers. She was given electroshock, and she never again remembered any of her children, her husband, anyone. And if you look at it, this is a frightening price because some doctor wanted to give electroshock. Even when memory loss is not that extensive, it still has profoundly interferes with people. I'd like to briefly quote from testimony with a shock survivor and a fellow activist Shirley Johnson gave to a meeting of the Toronto Board of Health. She said, and I quote, "The memory loss is especially painful, since I could not remember a lot of times when the children were growing up, the two younger girls more so, since the shocks were closer to their birth. The two older children, I do not remember their graduation. Many times my family and friends would bring up happenings that I had to question them about to test whether the memory would return. I feel so alien because of this damage. I used to cover up a lot of times, thinking if I listened more and rested a lot before going out, it would be easier. Finally, when the anxiety got so bad, I would completely avoid people, and especially social gatherings where I was supposed to know people and remember their names," unquote. I want you to imagine the devastation for women whose primary identities are mothers that cannot remember their various things that happened to their children. I also want to add, while we're on Shirley, that one of the last times Shirley was electroshocked in another ward in the same hospital, her son was being electroshocked. And her son was a musician, and it deprived him of his ability to remember music because you don't know what's going to go. And he killed himself. And so look at the devastation of shock on this family. Some people are robbed of their ability to read, and for people who are involved in literacy programs, some of the people you have in the program could once read, and now can't, and aren't going to want to tell you about it because they're embarrassed, and aren't going to pick it up easily because they can't remember new stuff. Is there a way of predicting how much memory or what memory will go? No. That's the difficult thing about memory loss. There's no way of choosing which memories to eradicate, and there's no way of memory of knowing how much damage that could be, is going to be done. A person could have 8 shock and have minimal damage. A person could have 1 shock and have horrendous damage. The point is, shooting electricity through someone's brain is a bit like letting a bull loose in a china shop. You know there's going to be havoc wreaked. You just don't know where and how much. Doctors themselves, I'd like to add, are really aware on some level that it creates memory loss. They have to be with all the proof. Indeed, in many cases, they are not only aware of the memory loss, despite denying or trivializing it, they are counting on memory loss. Insight into this dynamic, actually, I got the first time I was called into a review board hearing. That's where patients contest attempts to do things against their will. There was a psychiatrist at the Clark wanting to electroshock a woman against her will. Not an uncommon desire for psychiatrists. I don't want to pretend to you this woman had no problems. There are people who are electroshocked who have very few problems before shock compared to after, and who didn't have seriously troubled, and I'll get to that later. This woman wasn't among them. She did have serious difficulties. However, she, not so serious that she mistook shock for a good treatment. She was very clear she didn't want it. And he went to her estranged husband and asked for permission, the psychiatrist, to give shock. Anyway, there's another case that happened with as well, so I'll leave that. I was called into the review board hearing because the lawyer for the woman wanted help in having this woman not shocked. And, we did a few things to impress the review board. And then we're sitting in the review board, and the psychiatrist makes one claim after another. And the most damaging claim, and you can just look at what psychiatry's priorities here, is that she hadn't kept up down a job in her life. All right. So we listen to all these claims, and it strikes both the lawyer and I, we don't know if any of them are true, because we haven't been allowed to look at her chart. And so the review board stops for half an hour. Well, we're allowed quickly in half an hour to look at this woman's chart before they go on with a hearing that could result in her having brain damage. And we look at the chart, and lo and behold, she'd kept down a job right until 3 months ago. And it wasn't the only lie. There was one lie after another. And on the basis of those what the psychiatrist called accidental misrepresentations, we won the case and she wasn't shocked. But the significant truth came to me about what psychiatrists think just before we went back into the hearing. He called the lawyer and myself aside and he said, "Don't put up a case. Just let me shock her. Because she's not eating right now, but after we shock her, she'll forget why she wasn't eating and she'll eat." So I won't tell you who it is, but he still works there. Huh? He didn't get into any trouble for any of us, because this is pretty standard. In other words, this psychiatrist not only knew about memory loss, in his decision around treatment, he counted on memory loss. What this psychiatrist did is very, very common. Shock is frequently used precisely to erase memory that is causing the person problems, and even more, that's causing other people problems. And indeed, often the person feels a bit better, not always, but sometimes they do, because they no longer remember what's bothering them. The problem is, no one tells them what the treatment does and that they're going to be brain damaged for life. The problem is, people cannot solve problems when they can't remember them. We need our memory to work through issues. One of the tragedies of this so-called process is that people are left with no way of addressing what is bothering them because they cannot remember what is bothering them. And so they continue to be plagued. Imagine in this regard a childhood sexual abuse survivor whose memories are just beginning to surface, who gets depressed and confused and who is electroshocked, and you'll get some sense of how counterproductive this treatment is. I'd like to add that I've worked with a number of shock survivors who appear to have had something very traumatic happen in their childhood, but we can't get at it. not because they've repressed it, but because the shock has made it inaccessible. Routinely, shock is used precisely to wipe out memory that causes the person trouble, and the person ends up severely impaired in their ability to navigate the world. This is routine and intentional use of shock to damage the brain. At this point, I've asked you to look beyond the level that I've been operating at now to just visit another level, and we'll be visiting there more often as time goes on. So you look behind what might look like benign intentions and see the social function that shock serves. Shock is an instrument of control. It controls vulnerable people and indeed oppressed people. And so in this case, in the case of a childhood sexual abuse survivor, the operant wisdom is, even if people aren't conscious this is what they're doing, don't do anything about the problems in living that people have. Don't do anything about the problems in coping that men don't understand. Just shock childhood sexual abuse survivors so they'll forget their obsessions and be more manageable. They did this before they recognized that women are depressed from oppressive conditions. And now that the medical profession officially recognizes oppressive conditions, they still theorize women as disordered and shock women. To go one stage further, the erasure of memory is sometimes even done for the direct benefit of specific others. For memory, in particular, women's memory may not be in the interests of others. And what goes along with this, shock is sometimes given as a punishment or a threat both to women and men. In this regard, I'd like to remind people of the case of Cheryl Brown, which hit Toronto big time. I can see people from Toronto Rape Crisis Center. You must remember the case of Cheryl Brown. Cheryl was sexually abused by her psychiatrist, Dr. Henry Fenickstein. Fenickstein threatened her with shock if she ever revealed it. Well, in this case, it was the psychiatrist whose interest was served, as it often is. It may be someone other than the psychiatrist whose interest the erasure of memory serves. Though I don't want to unduly emphasize this, I have certainly known many people who were shocked once they started suggesting the possibility of sexual abuse. And so one scenario that we sometimes see is the father sexually abuses the daughter. As the daughter grows up, she starts making accusations while acting in ways that others recognize or think of as strange, and the father signs for electroshock. Sometimes wiping out of memory is part of a general philosophy about mental illness, as in the case with shock doctor Dr. Ewan Cameron, and let's put a bookmark in that because I will have a lot more to say about Cameron in a few moments. I've been talking so far about brain damage and memory loss. Well, these effects are invariable. There are also other common effects of shock, and it's a huge and frightening list, but I want to name a few. So just to name a few, these include confusion, physical weakness, cardiovascular complications, lower IQ, delirium, brainwave abnormalities, epilepsy, learning disabilities, and death. From what I've been saying to date, I'm sure that you're getting a sense of why I'm saying this procedure is bad, like real bad. It's fraudulent, it's unacceptably injurious, and it's dehumanizing. It is essentially nothing but a medically induced closed head injury masquerading as treatment, and it seriously detracts from people's ability to lead a full life. You're also probably beginning to see why I am calling it a feminist issue. It controls women. It punishes women, it threatens women, it protects abusive men. But you may be wondering why I keep saying women and why I am emphasizing that it is a feminist issue. So let me proceed now to who gets shock. In short, disproportionately, women get this abysmal treatment. Throughout the history of electroshock, women have received shock 2 to 3 times as often as men. This was true in the 60s, this was true in the 70s, this was true in the 80s, this is true today. It is true in every country in the world in which shock is given, which is the vast majority of countries, but let's stick for a second to Ontario. So this is the last stats that I have on overhead. So number of ECTs given provincially, 15,593. number of patients, 2,554. We now are given stats for provincial psychiatric institutions because the community psychiatric institutions don't end up breaking it down by gender, which is why we've suddenly gone to provincial institutions. The percentage of patients given ECT in provincial institutions that are women, 71%. Percentage of ECT given in provincial institutions given to women, 75%. In other words, 75% of the shock given in provincial institutions in Ontario is given to women. 25% to men. You can do the... Will someone unplug it for a second? Because there's a strange thing that happens to this. It just starts having a heart attack on us. And thank you, and makes noise. Okay, so you can see that's three times the amount given to men. So there's a huge discrepancy between women and men. The vast majority of treatments given are given to women. And put this together with what I've demonstrated so far... Largely, then, it is women's brains that are ravished. It is women that are robbed of their memory. It is women that are told they're just being neurotic when they complain of memory loss, when they say they can't get through the day without taking notes, when they say they can't remember people they're supposed to know. Now, it's also given to vulnerable men, and I don't want to forget men here, especially men less valued in the patriarchy. In this regard, I'd like to point out something, and people can ask me about it later. I'm not going into it because I'm focusing on women today, but gay men living with AIDS are in particular jeopardy of ECT. You can see then why it is so easy to trivialize survivor testimony. Discounting of women and other oppressed groups that is endemic to the patriarchy is written large when it comes to individuals in those groups who are conceptualized as mentally disordered. Something horrible isn't happening here, but in all fairness, we need to ask if there's anything about psychiatry's claims to effectiveness. So yes, shock does awful things, but what if it's really effective the way psychiatrists say? So I just want to deal with that before we go any further. I'd like to point out, though, that even if it was effective in some way, that wouldn't mitigate the damage to the core of the human being. It would not justify the profound misrepresentation of this procedure. On top of this, however, the claim to effectiveness is bogus. Let's take a look at that claim. What's electroshock supposed to do? Relieve depression. What do effectiveness studies say? Studies show conclusively that it is not effective in relieving depression. Brill did a controlled experiment with unmodified, modified, and simulated shock and showed that all three were just as effective. Simulated shock is where you don't do anything and they think they've had shock. Longitudinal studies by people like Johnston show that any greater effectiveness over a placebo disappears within 4 weeks. Within a month. So, in other words, these guys are zapping women's brains, damaging women's brains for 1 month of feeling high sometimes, and generally for nothing. Incidentally, I want to just say something quickly about why some people, and certainly you can see Connie never felt better for 1 week or 1 month, but I just want to say something about why sometimes people feel better for a month. I mentioned before because they forget what bothers them, and that's part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer. ECT, as I mentioned before, is medically induced brain injury. When the brain is injured, it releases endorphins. Our endorphins are kind of like our own opiates. They are a relative of opiates, and so it makes us high. What we have here is a temporary chemical high coming from brain injury. It's hardly a reason to permanently injure women's brains. It's not really that much different than hitting women over the head by a 2x4, which will also release endorphins, and calling it effective treatment. Now, I'm not against having endorphins produced, let me be clear. However, you can produce endorphins by having a brisk walk or going swimming. And to the best of my knowledge, that does not cause brain damage. It does not cause the brain to bleed. It does not wipe out memory. It does not destroy people's lives. It also doesn't require doctors, so I wouldn't hold my breath about them recommending it. Is there any other efficacy to ECT? Well, there's one other claim to effectiveness that psychiatry keeps putting forward. The claim is it is preventive It is effective in preventing suicide. Very strange claim. Are there studies investigating the question of suicide? Yes, there are. There was a study by Eastcock and Peacock, another study by Fernado. What do the studies show? Control studies with some trouble, people getting shock and some not, and there was no difference in suicide rate among those who were shocked and those who weren't shocked. In other words, it has no effectiveness in preventing suicide. Nonetheless, and you'll see it in all sorts of articles whenever shock is written about, it is effective, it is safe and effective, and it prevents suicide. So what do we have here? We have an ineffective, brain-damaging treatment that destroys people's lives, and it is overwhelmingly given to women. Why is it given overwhelmingly to women? Well, let me back up here before I answer that and say, why is it given at all? I think there's a lot of answers to this. I don't want to just try one. I think one of the reasons psychiatrists give it is they don't know what to do. They're not good therapists. Their drugs are useless. And so they, you know, once all that happens, if the person doesn't start feeling well by themselves just from being away from their family, it comes to mind to electroshock them. It also feels right to some doctors. There's a long history of within psychiatry of treatments that border on torture. There's a long history of treatments purposely meant to scare people, and electroshock fits very well into those. It's quick. It's a cheap way to address people's suffering in a dehumanizing society without actually having to address the causes of suffering, and so the government wouldn't mind supporting that. I want to be clear, though, that shock is an industry. It's not just a treatment. And it's an industry with vested interests involved. There is a huge literature out there that normalizes and regulates shock. Shock doctors are raised in the philosophy of shock. Shock doctors are major shareholders in companies that sell shock machines. Abrams is a case in point, eh, Don? Somatics, one of the biggest promoters of shock and one who teaches students to give it is the primary owner of Somatics, which is a shock machine. There are research grants given to you if you want to do research into shock, right? So there's a great vested interest. Now, you can't do research in shock unless you have participants. And what are participants? These are people that you shock. So this is a partial explanation. It's also an explanation why there's not more shock given. Because insofar as this is an industry, it's up against a much bigger industry with much more power, and that's the drug industry. The drug industry, you can make a lot more money from drugs than you can for shock. If that ever started reversing in any way, we could expect a whole lot more people shocked. It's also a partial explanation of why women are easier to force into shock. But it's still only a partial answer, so let me go back to the question. What do shock doctors say about the discrepancy? Why more women, 2 to 3 times as many women as men, are shocked? Do shock doctors deny that women get electroshock 2 to 3 times as often as men? No, they don't deny it. It's considered part of established wisdom. So how do psychiatrists rationalize the fact that women are given shock 2 to 3 times as often as men? They rationalize it by reminding us it is intended for depression and that women are depressed 2 to 3 times as often as men. Let me acknowledge there's some validity in what they're saying here. Women are depressed more than men. It's not, however, because there's something wrong with our brains or our bodies. It's not because there is a defect in our brains that cell damage will magically cure. We're depressed because we live in a sexist society. We're depressed because of battery. We're depressed because of relegation of women to second-class citizens. We're depressed because of social conditions. And it is these conditions that need to be changed, not our brains. In addition to that, as I've already indicated, it makes no sense shocking women for depression, for studies have proven that shock has no efficacy with depression. If this were not bad enough, there's one further problem with the psychiatric rationale. Psychiatrists, as I've stated, rationalize the disproportionate use of shock on the basis of the fact that women get depressed more than men. However, depression is only one diagnosis, only one condition for which electroshock is recommended and for which electroshock is given. And what do the figures say in respect to the other diagnosis? Women are given electroshock 2 to 3 times as often as men, irrespective of diagnosis. Well, we're not now into a much harder question to answer. Why is this the case? Well, despite the muddy thinking going on here, it does look like women's understandable emotional problems under the patriarchy is being pathologized, and that is a key reason why women are disproportionately shocked. Another salient answer, though that's not always the case, is that significant men in their lives have been known to push for, sometimes male partners. We've certainly seen cases where men have not liked how their wives are behaving. The women are sitting around depressed and not doing the dishes. But that's hardly the whole answer. And it's not just male partners, also other people in the patriarchy, also the shock doctors. Indeed, shock doctors have wanted to shock women even when the significant others, including male partners, do not want this to happen. And let me be clear, for the most part, families do not want this to happen. In the vast majority of cases, families fight to stop this from happening. Paradigmal in this case is the Mrs. T case, which goes even further than the one I alluded to earlier. Mrs. Key is a woman. T was a woman in Toronto who was hospitalized, and the doctor wanted to shock her. And he also went to an estranged husband. You know, you keep hearing this, and to give permission for Mrs. T to get shocked. And it's very frightening to me that people are willing to get signatures from estranged husbands who may not even be in a good relations with the people in question. Fortunately, this was a decent guy who did not have it in for her and wouldn't sign. The psychiatrist then worked his way down every single relative he could find, and all of them refused. At the end of this, he got together with 3 other psychiatrists, and the 4 of them sought and got permission from a review board. Now, eventually this had a happy ending, but if you look at the dynamic here, what we really have is 4 powerful men flexing their muscles to beat up on a depressed woman. A more fundamental answer to why women in particular get electroshock is that psychiatry is a patriarchal institution, and what goes along with this, approximately 90% of shock doctors are men. And significant in this regard is how the patriarchy still regards women. Men do not understand women and easily see women as defective, especially women experiencing emotional difficulty. Also, they're more likely to see women as needing extreme measures, which translates into imposed control. Women are seen as invalid, as not in control of our emotions, as needing to be kept within strict limits. Men's inability to understand women and discomfort with feeling, in other words, is a contributive factor. Obviously, another answer, as I was suggesting earlier, is shock wipes out memory, and women have memory that is sometimes very inconvenient for the patriarchy. Carla McKeag provided another answer. Carla McKeag is a lawyer in Toronto who's a shock survivor. When I asked Carla about the gender discrepancy, she answered, and I quote, "I think it's because women's brains are more expendable," unquote. There's something to what Carla is saying here. In this regard, I'd like to remind people of the Meyerson quote that I quoted a little while ago. Quote, "These people," somebody's tape is gone, "these people have more intelligence than they can handle." This quote takes on new meaning when we realize the vast majority of these people who have more intelligence than they can handle are women. I'd also like to point out that many of the early promoters of ECT explicitly recommended shock for women and for, quote, "men whose jobs did not require a lot of thinking," unquote. So what are the implications of these recommendations? If we look at the recommendation that it be given to men whose jobs do not require a lot of thinking, one obvious implication is a structural truth, that ultimately psychiatry is an agent of the capitalist state and in the service of industry. It's important to take this in again and not mistake it for a genuine service to human beings. If we ask, who are those men whose jobs do not require a lot of thinking, it isn't a large step to realize that these early advocates of shock, at very least, had in mind working class men and men of color. A more widespread truth about women enters in if we look at the whole recommendation that be given to women and men whose jobs do not require a lot of thinking. That is, the implication is, it's not such a serious thing to damage women's brains. The obvious implication is, women do not need to do a lot of thinking. Put this together, and what we have is the covering up of abuse, callousness toward women, profound disrespect for women, reduction of women to nothing but a pile of emotions which are, with a brain attached to them, which for the most part is in the way and you might want to reduce. We also see the standard infantilizing of women with all the players cast in the old roles. Men, and let me be clear on this, disproportionately white men, cast as competent parental father figure, women as child, cast as child. The aggrandizement of white men and the infantilizing of women is obvious throughout the testimony of women shock survivors. And I want to quote here from one survivor, Velma Orlico, who speaks of shock doctor Ewan Cameron, who I will get to talking about more about shortly. Quote, "Everybody in the hospital was very much in awe of Dr. Cameron. He strode through the hall like a giant. People would say, oh, there, but for God, goes God. I'd say, I can't. I can't take it anymore. I feel worse. And he'd walk down the hall a little way and say, come on now, lassie. You know you're going to do it. Scary, though, eh? I can see a play coming, Ruth. More generally, we see an attempt to control women, whether through memory loss, threat, punishment, terrorizing, or brainwashing. We see it generally, and we also see it in concrete cases. I want to remind you again of Connie Neal, who you saw at the beginning of this talk. What did she say? She said, so you be very good. You be very, very careful. Here was clearly a woman being controlled. I'd also like to use a historical example here. And I like to use historical examples because things were not so camouflaged in the past. So what happens is the dynamics are written large in the past because no one thought they had to hide them. And so what we see in the past are dynamics written large that give us a clue how to decode current experiences. So here I'm coming to Ewan Cameron. Ewan Cameron was particularly into control. As he combined control with purposeful attempts to wipe out memory, he's an instructive case. Ewan Cameron was the psychiatrist at the infamous Allen Memorial Institute in Montreal. And he was responsible for rapid electroshock and psychic driving. A combination of two things, depatterning and psychic driving. And listen to the word depatterning. Okay, depatterning was mainly the electroshock. So he gave people a number of electroshocks a day. And that was the depatterning. And what was depatterning? The idea was that you wipe the mind clean. Now, these are his words, not mine. He wrote them up in journals, nice, respected psychiatric journals. You wipe the mind clean in order to create, quote, a tabula rasa, unquote. That is, a blank sheet on which to write. Once you did that, you can then do the psychic driving and implant the messages people should have. So women and men both were subjected to this combination of shock and implanted messages coming from the tapes underneath their pillows as they were forced to sleep all the time. And common messages for women were, you are a bad mother, you are a bad wife. This is clearly an attempt to mold women into the wives and mothers required in the patriarchy. Shock doctors are still trying to wipe out women's memories. And additionally, they're still trying to force women to be good mothers and wives. I've already given you current examples with respect to memory. Let me give you a current example with respect to sexist conditioning and the sexist social control. My example is a woman shocked in 1990 whose name is Wendy Funk. Wendy was bullied into accepting shock in the 90s, and what was wrong with her? Was it one of those horrendous cases that someone had a lot of problems? No. She was tired, and she had a sore throat and went to the doctor, usually something you would hope would not be a dangerous process. And she was a social worker, and the doctor kept saying things like, you know, you really shouldn't work outside of the house. This is not fair to your husband and children. And she started crying, and then he said, well, you're obviously very upset. We need to put you in an institution. So she ended up in a psychiatric institution. And within a short time of being here, she was told she would be relegated to the back wards if she didn't have shock, that she would consent to shock if she cared at all about her family. And she needed shock because she was not acting like a proper wife and was, and here's the word, quote, consumed with feminist-type thinking, unquote. Again, a clear feminist issue for us here. So obviously, a very similar dynamic here has happened with Cameron, even though much more muted and more disguised. It doesn't take a lot of work to figure out what these people were about. It's not just wives and mothers, of course, that shock doctors try to control. I remind people here of the case of Sheila Gahuli. Sheila was a lesbian, and women are not supposed to be lesbians, for the patriarchy is nothing if not heterosexist. Sheila was given electroshock in the 1980s in BC for the unspeakable crime of being a lesbian. Significantly, after each shock, she was asked, do you still not want to be cured of being a lesbian? Again, not a hard case to crack on this one of what they're up to. Put together the issue of control with profound damage, which we know shock does, and what we are seeing here is state-supported form of violence against women. Electroshock is electrical assault on the brains of women. It is battery to women's brains. Men are battered, are battering, women are being battered, and as in traditional battery, women are being told it is for their own good. In battery, in this case, it's called treatment, and it is legitimated and paid for by the state. That said, let me put forward another answer to what ECT is, an incomplete one, I agree, but a terribly important one. ECT is a process by which societal disrespect for women is actualized. ECT is a device in the patriarchal control of women. ECT is state-legitimated violence against women. ECT is an electrified assault on women's brains, a rapist assault on women's brains. ECT is battery to women's brains, battery which, I remind you, causes permanent brain injury. This battery, this torture, is all the more insidious and harder to put your finger on because it is done in the name of help. It is part of hegemony, and so is accompanied by words like treatment, and it is done under the auspices of the state, and indeed, as Sue Clark put it, is paid for by the state. The signs of the battery are the signs we always find in violence against women. Actual physical damage from men attacking women's bodies, male threats, also one further dimension by which we have come to recognize full-blown violence against women, and that's the psychological aftermath. What are the psychological effects? Let me quote some of the testimony from hearings held into Shaw. Quote, I never felt so helpless and vulnerable in all my life, unquote. Quote, I was helpless in stopping this kind of treatment, unquote. Quote, it's degrading, it's humiliating, unquote. In this regard, I'd like also once again to remind you at the beginning of the speech of what Connie said. And let me just quote Connie. At the beginning of the clip, she said, it was meant to be punishment. At the end, she said, but the biggest thing, I think, is the business about the fear. This is something that just doesn't go away. All I did was have a baby. And look at what they did to me. Now, if I really did something, what would they do to me then? So you be very, very careful. You be very quiet. You don't raise your head. You fit in. You play a role. I have combed through testimony by women shock survivors, such as Connie, and can clearly identify the expectable and routine psychological effects of electroshock. They are sense of helplessness, low self-esteem, humiliation, terror, ongoing effort to please so as not to be punished further, also initial minimization, denial, attempt to hide the damage. Does it sound familiar? As feminists, we have been talking about this combination of responses long enough, we should have no trouble recognizing them. They are the traditional responses to battery of women, to violence against women, documented by feminist after feminist, by Walker, by Lobel, by all of the major theorists. The parallel is clear. Women battered by male partners end up with low self-esteem, feeling terror, feeling helpless, experiencing loss of control, try to please the abuser, try to minimize. So do women shock survivors. What we have here is physical damage inherent in violence against women, the traditional reasons for violence against women, the attitudes toward women, male sexism, societal sexism, and recognizable psychological responses to violence against women. We have something that is very recognizable here if we dare to recognize it. What we have here, moreover, and we should all be able to recognize it, is the profound traumatization of women in the name of help. You heard, Connie, and you surely heard the trauma. I have already named a number of standard features of trauma that pertain to shock, sense of danger, terror, low self-esteem. Just in case there's any doubt, I'd also like to name other attributes of trauma that you clearly find with shock survivors. Being haunted by it, having nightmares about it, re-experiencing it so the person feels it's happening to them all over again, so that it's happening now. Also, as in all trauma, women are frequently triggered by stuff that ends up associated with the traumatic event. For a number of shock survivors I know, they're triggered by anything electrical, by electric cords, by electrical outlets. As I said, what we have here is recognizable if we dare to recognize it. My invitation today is that we dare to recognize it, that we start taking it seriously, that we throw away garbage terms like treatment and therapy, that we reconceptualize electroshock as a serious form of violence against women, as the traumatizing of women, and that we mobilize against that violence just as we've mobilized against wife battery and childhood sexual abuse. Let me be clear. The anti-psychiatry movement has been mobilizing against shock for decades, and that mobilization has always included some awareness of feminist issues. We have demonstrated, we've made innumerable deputations, we've held public hearings, but that movement can only get so far. The strategic need at this juncture is an alliance between feminist organizations and anti-psychiatry organizations. More generally, I'd like to see more feminists take up the battle. In the meantime, I'd like to at least have us find ways to safeguard women in special jeopardy. And don't get me wrong, I also would like to safeguard men in special jeopardy. If we are to protect women, of course, it is important that we have some understanding which women are in particular jeopardy of this treatment. So which women are in particular jeopardy? Obviously, all severely depressed women. However, one form of depression really jumps out at you as you start reading women's testimony about their own victimization. And this is not one related to abuse. Shirley Johnson, who I referred to earlier, is paradigmal in this case. In her testimony to the Board of Health, Shirley said she got shock for depression just after the birth of her fourth child. In our hearings about shock, we heard similar statements again and again. I received shock just after the birth of my second child. I received shock just after the birth of my third child. What is happening here? Just after giving birth, women are experiencing a completely natural event that we all know about, postpartum depression. It is not a disease. It'll go away by itself. And for this completely natural occurrence that does not need to be treated, they are subjected to brain-damaging treatment. We need to be aware here and to find ways to safeguard the women. What other women are in special jeopardy? Women with so-called eating disorders. Housewives, now there's a big category. Lesbians, gay men living with AIDS. Let me go off women and just go on to people generally. It's not clear whether people of color are in more jeopardy, and we don't get it represented in the shock statistics, so they don't do the breakdown. We need the breakdown, given that this is the psychiatry institution, which has a long, long history of racism. The young are another vulnerable group. Could you plug in the machine for me again, this one, because I'm going to need this. Thank you very much. You haven't got it. Thank you. This brings me a particularly vulnerable group, and that's a vulnerable group that is vulnerable across gender, class, and race. And I want to end with a discussion of this group, and that's the elderly. Just as shock is given disproportionately to women, shock is given disproportionately to the elderly. In fact, it is given so commonly to the elderly that we might similarly call shock a form of elder abuse. And so, and as we know, elder abuse is on the rise in advanced capitalism. The disproportionate use of electroshock with the elderly is a comparatively new trend, but a very strong trend. One, of course, that fits right into the dominant approaches to the elderly, the warehousing, the drugging, and so forth. What rationale do psychiatrists give for disproportionately shocking the elderly? That they have to use electroshock because the psychiatric drugs pose a problem for the elderly with heart problems. Let me be clear. I have absolutely no problem with psychiatrists not giving the elderly these horrible drugs. I have a major problem with them saying, let's shock them instead. The elderly may already be suffering from confusion, from memory loss, and shock exacerbates this. Moreover, the more fragile the brain, the greater the risk that shock will result in extensive brain damage, and like every other part of our bodies, our brains are more fragile as we get older. On top of this, electroshock poses a danger to the heart. It's ironic that psychiatrists want to give shock rather than drugs to the elderly because of heart problems. Zielinski did research into the use of electroshock with the elderly with heart problems as far back as 1993, and the research indicates that 20% of the elderly with mild to severe heart conditions develop cardiovascular complications while being subjected to electroshock. In other words, the various treatments psychiatrists give the elderly to avoid treatments that are hard on the heart are known to be hard on the heart, and that on top of causing massive memory loss. Other common effects on the elderly, which have been well documented, include delirium, organic brain syndrome, and acute confusional states. Given women are at special risk of electroshock, and the elderly are at risk, of course, it only stands to reason that older women are in enormous jeopardy. So what do the stats say? Well, the stats divided up between women who are with the concept of over 60, women over 60. And women over 60 are not a huge percentage of the population at, you know, give us another 10 years and we will be. But at the moment, we're not a huge percentage of the population. And so if everything were equal, we wouldn't be getting very much of the shock. Well, what percentage do women over 60 get? 40% of the shock recipients in Ontario are women. Women over 60 get 52% of the electroshock given in Ontario. Women over 60. Obviously, in this sexist age of society, elderly women's brains are especially expendable. We now, again, are getting an answer to who these people are who have more intelligence than they can handle. This figure could not happen unless there were disrespect for elder women on the part of psychiatry and on the part of psychiatry and part of society in general. That, I would suggest, is part of the answer. Depression as a result of societal neglect, as a result of societal ageism, societal sexism, is another. As we are all well aware in this room, as women get older and past childbearing years, women's situation frequently worsens. Women are no longer needed in many arenas, as they are not producing children, not raising children, and are no longer of that same service to the patriarchy. Additionally, in many cases, women, as they get older, get very poor, so they're not able to buffer themselves against old age. They have more objective troubles. Given this, it is not surprising that many older women are depressed. What is sad is that older women are then punished for that depression by being subjected to further damage, and yet that is expectable because for psychiatry, depression is a license to shock, the person being a woman is a license to shock, and the person being old is a license to shock. What compounds this problem? There is often now no one there to protect elderly women from being shocked, no one there to stand up for elderly women, and so older women are being shocked again and again and again. I've only known of one jurisdiction to pay any attention to this special jeopardy in which older women find themselves, this travesty that faces older women. San Francisco in 1990. In 1990, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors chose to withdraw public funding for electroshock precisely because older women were being shocked zealously. No such initiative has ever happened in Canada, and yet the same problem exists in Canada, in Ontario, and in Toronto. As feminists, let me suggest we take the shocking of women seniors very seriously. And that said, I'd like to end by inviting people to identify. Many of us, women and men both, are already seeing the effects of age on our brains. We forget names. Some of us forget appointments. I know I won't name any names. Some of us forget appointments. That's a nuisance for us now. I ask you to imagine how very much worse things could get if you had 150 volts of electricity surging through your brains. Women are the caregivers in society. Women serve society. After this service, is this what women have to look forward to? Is this the reward? Is this acceptable or palatable to us? I'm taking questions. Thank you.